From the studios in KPCW Radio in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. If we can understand it, so can you. This is Scott Greenberg, and today, Lynn Ware Peake and I talk with Bill McKibben, a journalist, an environmentalist, and educator about the science of solar power in his newest book, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. Bill explains why he believes that solar power is the Earth's best and possibly last real shot at turning the corner on climate change. Next, we catch up with Dr. Pearl Sandick, a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy and interim dean in the College of Science at the University of Utah, to talk about the university's completion of its $97 million applied science project, which completes the Crocker Science Complex, creating a combined 275,000 square foot state-of-the-art hub for scientific research and education. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Today, we're talking about the science of solar power with someone whose voice has been at the center of the climate conversation for more than three decades. Bill McKibben is a journalist, an environmentalist, and an educator.
Bill joins us to talk about his newest book, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. In this urgent yet hopeful work, he argues that solar energy isn't just a clean alternative. It's our last real shot at turning things around and maybe even reshaping society for the better.
So sit back, soak up some sunlight, and let's dive in. Bill, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, what a pleasure to be with you all and to get to talk science for a little while.
Well, we love it, and we're excited to speak with you. You know, you have this great hope for solar energy. And it's really refreshing because I feel like in recent history, there have been so many naysayers, and knowing that we have gotten most of our solar panels from China, and now all the components that are coming from China and the tariffs and all that, it just starts to feel a bit prohibitive. So help me out with that one.
So what's happening right now is around the world, a kind of breakout of solar power. And when I say solar power, I mean both solar panels and wind power, since the wind is just another function of what the sun does on our planet. It heats the planet differentially, creating the winds that turn those majestic turbines. Both these forms of energy are now absolutely ascendant on a global level. In the last 5 years or so, they crossed some invisible line where they became cheaper than power from burning coal and gas and oil. And that was really an epochal moment for our civilization, because it opened the door to to turning our back on 700,000 years of setting things on fire as our way of getting things done, you know? And we can talk about why fire was both an excellent choice for our species and in the last couple of decades, a kind of disastrous one. But now we have this incredible opportunity to take advantage of the fact that, you know, there's a large ball of burning gas 93 million miles up in the sky, and we know how to make absolute full use of it. In the places that are, change is happening at a staggering scale. Solar energy is not just the fastest growing form of energy in the world now, it's the fastest growing form of energy we've ever seen on this planet. 96% of all new generating capacity in the world last year came from sun and from wind. And when you see the places where they've really dug in, you see incredible things. So, for instance, California is the state in the U.S. that got in earliest and worked hardest at this. And they passed some kind of tipping point in the last year. Now, day after day, California produces more than 100% of the electricity that it uses for long stretches from renewable power. That means that at night, when the sun goes down, the biggest source of supply to the grid is usually batteries that have been soaking up excess sunshine all afternoon. And bottom line, it means that California, fourth largest economy on Earth, is using 40% less natural gas to produce electricity than they were 2 years ago.
Mm.
That's probably the most encouraging statistic I've heard in almost 40 years of working on the climate crisis. That's the kind of number that on a global scale changes how hot the temperature gets if we can spread it everywhere. And it's spreading at least a few places. The state that's now surpassed California as the biggest, most aggressive installer of sun, wind, and batteries is Texas, which is kind of incredible since mm-hmm. Texas is also the home of the world's kind of hydrocarbon headquarters. But everything that's happening in the U.S. pales in comparison to what's happening in China. The Chinese are currently installing about a gigawatt of solar, a gigawatt's the rough equivalent of a coal-fired power plant, every 8 hours. They're putting up 3 coal-fired power plants worth of solar panels every day. Forget petrostates, they've become or are on the verge of becoming the first electrostate mm-hmm. on the planet, and it's driving down their emissions.
Yeah, so this is interesting. And also reading your book, it makes me think of back in the 70s when there were solar panels on the White House during the Jimmy Carter administration. And when Reagan, as we know, was elected, off came the panels and down went the incentives for pursuing this renewable energy. Meanwhile, China has been very aggressively pursuing it. It makes me wonder, you probably know the statistics for this, you know, had we been going at that point full steam ahead like China has been, where would we be now?
Well, Jimmy Carter's last budget called for enough research into solar to make sure that by the year 2000, 20% of America's energy supply would be coming from solar panels. Had we done that, and there's really no technical reason that we couldn't have, there's not been some astonishing breakthrough that wasn't available to us then. Had we done that, not only would America be in a different place, but the temperature of the planet would be profoundly different because we would have had these renewables ready to go at the moment that China's industrialization hit full speed ahead. There'd be a lot less carbon in the air. That didn't happen, obviously. This is our second bite at the apple.
Mm-hmm.
And this one we have to take because we've run out of room. I mean, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said that in order to be on anything like the path we set out in Paris 10 years ago, we need to cut emissions worldwide in half by 2030. The only thing capable of even approaching that scale of emissions reduction is the very rapid build out of sun, wind, and batteries. There's a lot of other things that 20 years from now may be playing some role. Small modular nuclear reactors, geothermal power, tidal power, you know, on and on and on. But for the critical period for climate change, what we have are sun, wind, and batteries. And the point that I think really needs to get across is we've talked about these things for a long time as alternative energy, and that has sort of gotten stuck in our heads. But that's not what they are now. This is the obvious, common sense, straightforward. This is not the Whole Foods of energy, nice but pricey. This is the Costco of power. Cheap, available in bulk, on the shelf, ready to go.
The Costco of power. I love it. Your subtitle refers to a last chance for the climate. And I know that in Europe, they just reached a marker where they claim or have reported that they have produced more power from, and I'm going to put air quotes around alternative energy, than from fossil fuels in the EU, which is amazing. I'm wondering how close are we globally to a tipping point, and what gives you hope that solar energy can still make the biggest difference here?
So it's all about, Scott, the rate of expansion here. The world is this summer producing 30% more energy from the sun than it did last summer. And if we can keep that kind of exponential growth really going for a few more years, then by next year, solar power should be the single biggest, next year or the year after, the single biggest source of generating capacity on the planet, I think. We're really moving fast now, and a few more years of this kind of growth and we'll be, you know, globally where California is at the moment. But of course, the fossil fuel industry has recognized this, doesn't like it, and is fighting back hard. That's why, you know, our Congress just got rid of the all the incentives in America to do anything about this under the Inflation Reduction Act. So sadly, this is becoming a political issue instead of the sort of straightforward physics and economics issue that one would hope it had remained.
Wow. Okay. So in your book, you do not shy away from naming the fossil fuel industry as a major roadblock, which you just touched on. How should we confront their influence? I mean, legally, politically, economically, what are the challenges that are involved with this?
I think that this is a really interesting question. We're in the midst of organizing this big action for September 21st, the autumnal equinox that we're calling Sun Day. That'll be a big celebration of all things renewable, and in many places, a kind of protest against those forces that are trying to block it. And, you know, it'll be probably mostly kind of progressives and liberals and things, but there are lots and lots of other people joining in. One of the interesting things about solar power is that it's, the polling indicates that it's wildly popular among people of all political persuasions. And I think sometimes for different reasons. I think my sense, I've lived in rural America my whole life in red and purple parts of it. So many, many of my neighbors would call themselves conservatives. And for them, solar power, I mean, if you're committed to the idea that your home is your castle that you're going to defend with your AR-15, you know, then having solar panels on your roof really makes your home your castle. If you're a good liberal, then, you know, we're networking the groovy power of the sun. That's cool, too. We can work across that kind of divide. And sometimes we're starting to see really interesting things. Let me give you an example. In Europe over the last 2 years, there's been an explosion of this thing called balcony solar, where people in their apartments without a roof to work with go to IKEA and get a solar panel for a few hundred euros, hang it off the railing of their balcony, plug it into their wall, and in many cases are producing 20% of the power they use. That's illegal everywhere in the U.S., except in the great state of Utah, where the quite red state legislature unanimously passed legislation earlier this year making this balcony solar legal in the Deseret State. And that's a beautiful reminder that this cuts across ideological lines in really useful ways.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I will say I was up on my roof cleaning off the solar panels, just making sure that they could get the maximum amount of sun energy that they could. One of them is starting to pull away. They're about 10 years old. One of the kind of edges of it is pulling away. And it made me think about, okay, what am I going to do? How long are these going to last? Will I be buying solar panels from China or now Vietnam or some of these other countries? You know, what is that going to look like?
Sure. So the first thing is they're probably going to last, most of them, a long time. I've had mine up for 25 years and they're still doing great. We actually keep installing them. We have four different generations. And the amazing thing is that these things are not just getting a little better, they're getting way better. So the solar panels I put up last year are more than twice as efficient as the ones from a quarter century ago. And not only that, they use way less materials. So if I took down a solar panel that I put up in the year 2000 here, there's enough silver and other recyclable minerals in it to build 8 or 10 solar panels now from that one. At a certain point, not very far off, we're never going to have to mine this stuff again because we'll be able to just keep recycling it. And those recycling... So this is what should be happening. And we should be producing solar panels in the U.S. at volume. That was one of the things that the Biden administration set out to do with this Inflation Reduction Act. And that's, of course, the thing that now is being killed. Our current government has really is waging a full-on war against solar power. Just the other day, the Secretary of the Interior declared that essentially federal land was now off limits to sun and wind. And this is, I'm afraid, just transparent doing of favors for people who provided large sums of campaign finance. The fossil fuel industry is rightly scared. They look around the world and see this change coming very fast, not just with solar panels, but with the technologies that make use of them. So in China this year, more than 50% of cars will be sold with a plug dangling out the back. This means that our projections about how much gas we're going to use 5 and 10 years from now are wrong. We're going to use way, way less gasoline. It's possible that 20 years from now, the U.S. will be a kind of museum of internal combustion that the rest of the world will come visit to see what, you know, how people lived in the olden days. But I think it's probably more likely that at a certain point, the dam will break and American consumers will demand the same kind of cheap and incredibly functional cars that are now appearing in the rest of the world.
Right. Can we go back to Texas for a bit? I mean, it makes sense. California, a liberal state, but Texas, as you say, you know, a big base of fossil fuel or you know, oil extraction and fossil fuels. Why Texas? Why is Texas, you know, it's just pure economics and
mostly
rationale?
So Texas is growing fast. Texas doesn't do a very good job with energy efficiency, unlike California. So they need to produce a ton of energy. And they've, at this point, understand that by far the cheapest and most grid-reliable way to do it is with sun, wind, and batteries. So they've been installing this stuff at a prodigious rate. The head of the Texas Utility Commission said a couple of weeks ago that their grid is far more stable than it has been in the past. As you'll recall, Texas has had trouble with blackouts and things. Far more stable because they've got all this renewable energy, but also all these batteries. And it's really worth reminding ourselves, you know, what a gift cheap that energy storage is. It basically allows the sun and the wind to operate around the clock. When the day comes that the entire American auto fleet is EVs, the battery storage power in our automobile fleet will be enough to power everything in the U.S. for 2 days if the grid all went down. So Texas has been moving very fast. The oil industry tried to slow this down this year. They introduced a lot of bills in the state legislature that would have penalized renewable energy. Some of them were, frankly, the ones that got close to passing were almost grotesque. They were basically DEI, but for natural gas. You know, if you wanted to install 5 megawatts of solar, you had to also install 5 megawatts of natural gas to go with it. These came very close to passing, but at the last minute, people appeared from around rural Texas to say, don't do this. These solar farms are now the thing that are funding our schools. This is what's allowing us to keep our hospital or our nursing home open, the revenues that we're getting from this. Don't mess with it. And the legislature went home without doing anything about it, and the Texas legislature only meets every 2 years, so it'll be a while before, one hopes, before they're able to screw things up. And by that time, you know, we will have passed some tipping point there. That's, I think, what's happening in place after place around the world. Once people really see this, there's no going back. So let me give you a really interesting example. Pakistan, poor country, great sufferer from climate change, big floods, hideous temperatures. They also have a very expensive and unreliable electric system, and they're directly next door to China. So it was easy to import cheap solar panels, and last year that started happening at volume. Pakistanis, working mostly off TikTok videos with Hindustani music in the background, learned how to install them, and in 8 months, put up the equivalent of half the country's national electric grid. If you look at Google Earth images from Lahore or Karachi or Islamabad, those solar panels spread like mushrooms after a rainy day. Just astonishing. And as a result, Pakistani farmers, say, are using 35% less diesel this year to run the irrigation pumps that on which their agriculture depends. Those kind of things can happen everywhere, and if they happen fast enough, then they will affect how bad climate change ends up being.
It feels like we're having a conversation where we're framing solar energy not just as a technology, but more as a moral imperative. And I'm curious, what role does the way we talk about solar impact our fight for climate change?
I think it's a moral imperative in a bunch of ways. It's not just the climate, though that's an existential issue that will determine what our world is like for thousands of years to come. It's also the fact that 9 million human beings die each year. That's one death in five on this planet from breathing the combustion byproducts of fossil fuel, mostly those particulates that lodge in our lungs. If you've been to Delhi in recent years, you know what I'm talking about. And all of that's unnecessary because we don't need to be burning stuff anymore. Not only that, and here's the kind of other moral part of this, I think. As long as we depend on an energy source that's only available in a few places, that's fossil fuel, I mean, scattered deposits, the people who control those places will end up with too much power, which they will abuse. So, for instance, the biggest, you know, fossil fuel baron in Europe is Vladimir Putin. And he's taken his winnings and he's used them to launch a land war in Europe in the 21st century. Contrast that with a world that ran on energy supplies that are available absolutely everywhere, because everywhere on the planet has wind and or sun. That world would be a very different place. Even human beings are going to be hard-pressed to figure out how to fight a war over sunlight.
So it feels to me, since sunlight is everywhere and fossil fuels are limited, that it could possibly be, what's the word I'm looking for? It sort of takes the handcuffs off utility companies on remote places. I mean, you could have villages throughout Africa putting up solar, and it could liberate underserved communities and indigenous nations here in the United States to be free from.
This is one of the saddest parts of what happened with the defunding of the IRA. There were indigenous communities across this country that were busily putting up solar for just the reasons that you said, and much of that money has suddenly been withdrawn, which is a great shame. But yes, for people who don't benefit right now from our energy world, this is a no-brainer. I've been in parts of Africa that were getting their first power from solar panels, and it was a reminder of how much we take for granted. Lynn, Scott, I was in a village in Ghana a couple of years ago where they just had turned on the solar panels the day before. And I was sitting with the village elders. It was very hot, you know, and they kept handing me bottles of cold water, for which I was grateful. But it took me 15 or 20 minutes in my clueless American way to figure out that the reason they were so proud to be handing me bottles of cold water was that until the day before, there'd never been anything cold in that village. There'd never been a refrigerator. And the things that, I mean, for us, the transition is less dramatic, you know? You flip the switch on your wall and the light goes on, whether it's coming from a belching coal-fired power plant or an elegant solar panel someplace. But it's a good reminder that there's something incredibly beautiful about being able to tap directly into the power of the sun. I mean, the good Lord was kind enough to hang the thing there for us. Oh, we might as well make some use of it. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so my mantra these days is energy from heaven, not from hell.
I like that. Bill, before we let you go, can you tell us a little more about Sunday, how we can get involved?
Yes. Go to sunday.earth. This is a very grassroots project from across the kind of coalition of people who care about the future. And it'll be a great day of celebration. There'll be EV and e-bike parades. There'll be people opening up their homes so their neighbors can see their heat pumps and, you know, have them demystified. And there'll be also, you know, protests in places at those those forces that are still trying to build gas pipelines or whatever it is when we have this cheap alternative available. I think it's going to be a beautiful day because, again, there's something aesthetically powerful about all this. You know, I took the title for this book, Here Comes the Sun, straight from George Harrison. It's, I think, worth noting that if you go to Spotify, that's the Beatles song that has twice as many streams as any other in their huge catalog. People love the gentle and optimistic idea, especially at a moment when it seems like almost everything is going wrong in our world. This is the thing that's going right in a big way. And if we seize it, maybe it'll help us break down some of the troubles that we're in.
Our guest is Bill McKibben, and his book, as he said, is called Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Change for Civilization. Bill, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank both of you for keeping beating the drum for science.
Dr. Pearl Sandick is a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy and interim dean in the College of Science at the University of Utah. She has previously served as associate chair of the Department of Physics and Astronomy and associate dean for faculty and research in the College of Science. Professor Sandick is a theoretical particle physicist studying physics beyond the standard model, including possible explanations for the dark matter in the universe. She joins us today on Cool Science Radio to discuss the University of Utah's completion of its $97 million applied science project, which combines the renovated historic William Stewart Building with the new L.S. Skaggs Appliance Science Building. The project, along with the existing Crocker Science Center, now completes the Crocker Science Complex, creating a combined 275,000 square feet state-of-the-art hub for scientific research and education at the University of Utah. Dr. Sandick, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for making the time. I know you're very, very busy these days. But last month, you unveiled the beautiful new and updated facilities at the University of Utah, the new L.S. Skaggs Applied Science Building and the renovated historic Stewart Building. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about these facilities?
Absolutely. These are really transformative facilities for science education and research here at the University of Utah. The two new spaces together, the L.S. Skaggs Applied Science Building and the renovated William Stewart Building, create about 140,000 square feet of state-of-the-art facilities. And combined with the existing Crocker Science Center, you mentioned that completes the Crocker Science Complex, which is this huge hub for scientific discovery and learning that really impacts tons of people here on campus and beyond. I just want to say there are a couple aspects of this project. There are a lot of aspects of this project that are really special. And one of them is that in the Applied Science Complex, in the Applied Science Building and the Stewart Building, we're able to bring together the Department of Physics and Astronomy, the Department of Atmospheric Science, and the Wilk Center for Climate Science and Policy. So it's a really spectacular space, and it's going to have a tremendous impact.
Wow. So what kind of research exactly is going to be happening in these facilities? I mean, as a particle physicist, you could probably tell us more about the physics research that will be taking place, but it sounds like it's going to be collaborative across a number of different fields.
Yeah, absolutely. There are tons of types of research going on here. So in the College of Science and in these facilities, our researchers, which includes students, by the way, are working to address like all different kinds of challenges, some of the most pressing challenges of society, and some things that are really like fueling our curiosity or satisfying our curiosity. So there are things like air quality and water management, energy innovation, quantum computing. These facilities are really going to support that work. And then on the basic science side, you know, I'm talking about helping us answer fundamental questions like about why things are the way they are. Like, what is the dark matter in the universe? How do galaxies or black holes form? And what are the particles that are bombarding us from space? So whether it's addressing like human curiosity or challenges that are really affecting the lives of people in Utah and beyond on a daily basis, the work done here is going to have impact across the state of Utah and beyond.
That sounds like a lot of different stuff going on. What makes this facility so unique? Are there special labs or special equipment that has been installed here?
Yeah, there's the specialty equipment aspect and facilities aspect. And then there's also like the organization of the space. So it really, the Crocker Science Complex and these buildings in particular bring together cutting edge research with undergraduate education in a way that few universities in the region or really in the country can match. So we have students in the Applied Science Building. We have students who are learning introductory physics labs that are like right next to world-class research in quantum materials and atmospheric science. So it's a really cool way to bring together. And I can talk a little bit more about what that enables in terms of the student learning. But on the facilities side, the new facilities are really specialized to allow us to enhance our research on semiconductor technology, biotechnology, data science, hazardous weather forecasting, and tons of areas. I already mentioned air quality. One of the cool things is that we have a facility that monitors and tracks like dust and aerosols and particulate matter. So we can, you know, that's useful for a variety of reasons, both to train students and for the research that's coming out of that, which we can use to inform policymakers, you know. We also have, I mentioned quantum computing, and in the basement, we actually have a world-class cryogenic facility, which allows us to explore the design and properties of quantum superconducting materials, which is also extremely cool. It's a combination of like these really specialized research facilities and also the educational opportunities that those are enabling that makes this like a fantastic and unique facility for the state.
Well, I have to say that a cryogenic facility is really cool.
Really cool.
And that's the name, Cool Science Radio. Something you touched on with the particulate studies that are going on. Just kind of curious, with the Great Salt Lake slowly evaporating and the particles that we're hearing about being spun about in the air, is that something that your program is paying attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of what is going to be investigated in this building as well. So it plays a huge role in things that are going on and are really pressing issues for the people here, like around the Great Salt Lake. But there's a lot we can learn that will affect communities across Utah and beyond too.
Now, you mentioned that these students are coming into the facility from a variety of different fields of study. How is it that you plan on seeing more of collaborative interactions between these students and their different fields?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of ways that this is going to impact the student experience. And that's not just like students in physics and astronomy or atmospheric science. It's really students from across campus. So this facility is actually going to serve basically every student pursuing a STEM career at the University of Utah. So it's first year students all the way up through advanced researchers, graduate students in those programs. We know that students from 37 different degree programs across campus are actually going to be taking courses in this building. So it's a huge impact in terms of who's coming through. And really, it's students from a variety of different backgrounds, students from engineering, data science, nursing, our pre-med students, chemists. All of these students take courses in this building and are going to benefit from those facilities. There's one other sort of, well, there are a bunch of other ways, but there's one other thing that I wanted to mention, which is the sort of hands-on nature of the experiences that they're going to get. So, you know, students work in research labs across campus, but in the College of Science, we have a pretty special program called the Science Research Initiative, the SRI. And the idea is that every undergraduate student should be able to have a research experience to work in a research lab. So this program allows all incoming students to first take a one-credit course in research methods. And then in their second semester, they get placed in a research lab that aligns with their interests and with their career goals. And it's such a special thing. It's a really unusual program. It's unique in the region, and it's pretty unique across the country to be able to do that. And this space is really going to be able to increase the impact in terms of the types of labs, the research that they'll be doing that they have access to, and how they'll be working alongside faculty in those disciplines. So that's like a really, that's a very special thing, I think, and that affects students across the College of Science. But also for all those students from across campus and actually anybody walking by the building, I think they'll see that it's really just an inspiring space. So when you walk through the halls or you are talking with a colleague sitting in the atrium or participating in a class or you're in a lecture, a public lecture in the new auditorium, I hope I feel it. And I hope that it really inspires us to think about things in new ways and learn together in new ways and work together in new ways to address these like these issues that affect us all that science can help solve.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's been a while since I've been in school, and I was a bio-sci major back in the day, and I cannot imagine an English major being in an SRI program with me. But I think it's a really cool concept. I've never heard anything like this, that you've literally got from all different majors across the university can enroll in this SRI program.
Well, it's open to students who are in College of Science majors at the moment, but who knows what the future holds.
I think it's great. I mean, Dr. Sonda, I got to tell you, just hearing your enthusiasm for this, I wish I was back in school. I would love something like this. This is amazing. We see why the university prioritized this science complex.
Yeah, I mean, and also I would have to say, like, we would love to invite the public on campus too. We have some public events that happen pretty regularly. We have star parties on Wednesday nights that are going to start, I believe, in a couple weeks now, as soon as the observatory gets up and running. There's a fantastic facility on the roof that's been expanded to accommodate like more people. We want more people to come and experience a star party and learn about what's out there in the night sky. So I'm really excited for those to get started in a few weeks too.
You have an observatory?
We do. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, we have a fantastic observing facility that's open to the public every Wednesday when the weather is good. And you can check online for what events are coming up and what you'll be able to attend. But we have a great staff, and our students participate too, to really help everyone be able to see the things that they see in the night sky.
Oh, this is phenomenal. And it sounds like it's across so many different research areas. I just kind of wondering, how do you see the completion of this center impacting the broader economy in Utah, or does it?
Yeah, so you may have seen that Utah actually ranks first in the nation for innovation capacity, and innovation is a special thing, and this space directly supports that kind of work. So, I mean, you said it's a $97 million building. This is an investment in scientific innovation, and the hope is that this type of investment will lead to commercialization, job creation, and really ultimately increased economic stability. And that affects, you know, people in Utah who are working in these industries, their families. I also want to say that, like, that whole price tag, the Crocker Science Complex has been possible really as a partnership. So this is about working together with the state and with generous donors like Gary and Ann Crocker and the Alsem Foundation and many others. And, you know, again, the goal is that the discoveries and the prosperity that come out of this type of investment are going to enable future public and private investment and really fuel that cycle that's going to benefit the citizens of Utah and people beyond again and again. In terms of Utah's economic future, you know, some of the work that's happening there, I'm thinking about semiconductors, biotechnology, data science, air quality forecasting, I mentioned before, wildfire risk assessment and mitigation. The research really does cover a broad spectrum. And again, the hope is that this is going to contribute to not only like making things better for people here in Utah and beyond, but also to commercialization and job creation for decades to come. So it really is like, it's a strategic investment, and, you know, it's made possible by partnership with the state. And it's I think investments like this and this public-private partnership are a huge part of maintaining Utah's competitive edge in innovation.
I think it's wonderful. I could not be more thrilled. And to be quite candid, $97 million sounds like a bargain for what you accomplished at the University of Utah. As you know, by the way, we love University of Utah. We had Anil Seth on recently to talk about fast-moving stars and black holes and just fascinating stuff, the research that's going on. Now, I noted earlier in our your introduction that you are, and let me see if I get this right, a theoretical particle physicist studying physics beyond the Standard Model, including dark matter. This sounds very much like Sheldon and the Big Bang Theory. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the research that you're doing and actually how the new facility benefits your research?
Yeah, absolutely. I am a real person, though. I am not theoretical. But I study particle physics from the theory perspective. So I don't have a research lab, but I do have a team of fantastic students and postdocs. And we, you know, our angle on this is that we try to use all of the available data. People have been smashing particles together at colliders like at Fermilab or at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. People have been smashing particles together. People have been looking at the night sky with all different kinds of telescopes, building detectors to search for what might bump into a collection of really cold stuff. There's all this experimental data, and our goal is to figure out how to use all those pieces of information together to make progress towards figuring out what is dark matter. And we really don't know right now. We know from gravitational interactions that it is around us everywhere. It helped galaxies form the way they did. We couldn't have the galaxy that we have today without dark matter. And we have tons of cosmological evidence for the fact that it's around us and interacts gravitationally and played very important roles in the history of the universe. But we don't know what it is. It could be some kind of new particle, which is where this connects to my particle physics interest. It could also be something like a black hole that formed very early in the universe. We might have all these little black holes around us. But figuring out what that is has been one of the biggest puzzles in modern physics for, you know, generations now, actually, like since the 1930s, almost 100 years. We know a lot more now than we did then, but it's still a really interesting problem. And it feels like we're so close to an answer. So the tools that we have now are really special. And that's, I think it's just a really exciting question. And it's a great, it's also a great way for my students to get experience with a lot of different types of data at all different scales. We're talking cosmological scales down to nanoscales. So it's a lot of cool science that gets to go into that area too.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with Interim Dean of the College of Science and Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah, Dr. Pearl Sondek. And we just finished a very interesting conversation about dark matter. Now I'm going to go a little off script here because somebody recently told me about something called, and I may be getting this wrong, dark energy.
Dark energy, yes. And that is also a thing.
Also a thing that we don't know about?
We don't know what it is exactly, but we know a little bit about how it behaves. And this is a pretty exciting topic right now, too. Because there are some new measurements about the expansion history of the universe. And I'm hopeful that this can help us learn a little bit more about what dark energy might be.
Well, if you can tell from the enthusiasm in Professor Sandek's voice, it comes naturally because I have to mention this, that you were the recipient of the University of Utah's Distinguished Mentor Award. Congratulations. I can see why. I can see why. Just the way the energy, not the dark energy, the light energy that you talk about, science and the project going on right now at the University of Utah is infectious. And I am very excited about this. Now, part of the project includes a historically renovated and really well-known building on campus. Can you tell us a little bit more about the William Stewart Building and the role that it played in the renovation?
Yeah, so some people may have heard about the William Stewart Building before. It's once served as an elementary and middle school. We called it the lab school for campus. And it's really a great example of how we are like honoring our past while also building our future. So the William Stewart Building is about 40,000 square feet of this 140,000 square foot project. And the things that are in the Stewart Building, it's a lot of really fantastic classroom space. So was elementary and middle school classrooms, now classrooms for aspiring scientists and others. And there are also teaching labs, which are set up with fantastic equipment, and they are going to serve a huge number of students. So this is a place where we're able to serve these growing STEM majors and accommodate far more students than we were before. And as I said, the building itself is also just really great. So we preserved a lot of the original architectural elements and then also incorporated these state-of-the-art teaching laboratories. So it's like, again, it's kind of a perfect symbol of like honoring our campus history while also advancing the mission to train the next generation of scientists.
Wow. Well, I hope you've upgraded the desks. I can't imagine college students squeezing into little elementary school desks. But for our listeners, would you just remind them what the acronym STEM stands for?
Yes, science, technology, engineering, and math.
And on a personal note, I'm curious about the demographics of your students these days in the STEM program. Traditionally, science belonged to men in the way back days. And I'm just curious what that looks like now. Do we have more women enrolling in STEM classes, particularly at the U? Tell me what's going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have made a lot of progress in the last few decades. Some disciplines have reached sort of gender parity, which is fantastic. So disciplines like biology, chemistry is pretty close. You know, there doesn't seem to be the barrier, whatever it is, that used to exist. And that's due to so many different initiatives and all kinds of work. Since I was a graduate student, I've been really involved actually in gender equity and physics and astronomy, mostly in physics as my background. I served on the American Physical Society Committee on the Status of Women in Physics, and I learned a ton about initiatives and what can be successful to close this gap. When I first came to Utah in 2011, we actually had a much bigger problem with persistence for women students in STEM, or in physics in particular. So we would have, you know, maybe our first year class, the people just entering the university, we would be close to the national average in terms of the fraction of students who identified as women. But as they progressed, we were not graduating all of them. For some reason, they were leaving in the middle. And so one of the things that I wanted to do when I got here was kind of address that problem as a, you know, brand new junior faculty who wanted to take on every challenge. And we have done a lot of work to make sure that it's a welcoming environment. And I will say we are now at or above the national average, and we don't have this loss issue anymore. But we still across the nation have this issue that women are not pursuing physics at the same rate that men are. So it's about between 23 and 25% nationally right now.
Did you ever find out what the cause was in the way back of the dropout of women in sciences?
It's always a lot of factors. And I think for that reason, it takes a lot of different types of interventions. And a lot of those interventions are things that are good for everybody. Most of them, in fact. It's mostly just making things better so students have a better chance of success and feel more welcome. And that's good for everybody, right? So a lot of it is really just related to that.
Well, I can tell you I've got personal experience with that. I'm married to a brilliant woman who in the very way back days went into a field of medicine, radiation oncology, that required a lot of physics training. And I am so impressed with her career and the advances that they've made in that career. And I'm really glad that she stuck with it. So,
yeah, me too.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. It's been such a pleasure having you on Cool Science Radio. Again, please remind our listeners about the new center. It's called
the L.S. Skaggs Applied Science Building and the renovated William Stewart Building, which are part of the Crocker Science Complex.
Crocker Science Complex. And can people visit the complex? Is it open to the public at any particular time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is the western sort of part of the gateway to campus. So you'll see it as you walk along University Street. And, you know, there's a really nice plaza in the middle, like in the middle of the Crocker Science Complex, which is a fantastic gathering point. And again, star parties. So please do a little web search and come visit us for a star party.
Star parties with our star of the day, Dr. Pearl Sandek. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you so much for being here on Cool Science Radio with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you for tuning into Cool Science Radio. We'd like to thank our guests, author Bill McKibben and Dean Pearl Sandek. And thanks to our underwriters, San Francisco Design and IT Innovative. You can find this episode as well as past episodes on the KPCW website or on the new KPCW app. And if you like this episode, rate us and share it with a friend. If you have a suggestion for a guest or a topic for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And be sure to tune in next week when author Rebecca Tuhus-Dubrow joins us to talk about her new book, Atomic Dreams, The New Nuclear Evangelists and the Fight for the Future of Energy, as she explains why the narrative around nuclear power is shifting, what it could mean for our climate goals, and how one writer's own thinking transformed along the way. Then, we catch up with Jeff Merrifield, a former commissioner at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, about the new nuclear technologies and the future of power generation in the United States and around the world. That's next week at 9 a.m. on Cool Science Radio, right here on KPCW.